His voice was right. She instantly remembered it. And his smell, his gait, his laugh, the way his beard abraded her cheek. All of it combined to shatter her self-possession. She could feel a massive stone seal being pried open and the first rays of light entering an ancient, almost forgotten tomb. She swallowed and tried to gain control of herself, but seemingly inexhaustible waves of anguish poured out of her and she would weep again. He stood there patiently, reassuring her with the same look she now remembered he had given her from his post at the bottom of the staircase during her first solo journey down the big steps. More than anything else, she had longed to see him again, but she had suppressed the feeling, been impatient with it, because it was so clearly impossible to fulfill. She cried for all the years between herself and him. In her girlhood, and as a young woman, she would dream that he had come to her to tell her that his death had been a mistake. He was really fine. He would sweep her up into his arms. But she would pay for those brief respites with poignant reawakenings into a world in which he no longer was. Still, she had cherished those dreams and willingly paid their exorbitant tariff when the next morning she was forced to rediscover her loss and experience the agony again. Those phantom moments were all she had left of him. And now here he was, not a dream or a ghost, but flesh and blood, or close enough. He had called to her from the stars and she had come. She hugged him with all her might. She knew it was a trick, a reconstruction, a simulation, but it was flawless. For a moment she held him by the shoulders at arm's length. He was perfect. It was as if her father had these many years ago died and gone to heaven, and finally, by this unorthodox route, she had managed to rejoin him. She sobbed and embraced him again. It took her another minute to compose herself. If it had been Ken, say, she would have at least toyed with the idea that another dodecahedron, maybe a repaired Soviet machine, had made a later relay from the Earth to the center of the galaxy. But not for a moment could such a possibility be entertained for him. His remains were decaying in a cemetery by a lake. She wiped her eyes, laughing and crying at once. So what do I owe this apparition to? Robotics or hypnosis? Am I an artifact or a dream? You might ask that about anything. Even today, not a week goes by when I don't think that I'd give anything I had, just to spend a few minutes with my father again. Well, here I am, he said cheerfully, his hands raised, making a half turn so she could be sure that the back of him was there as well. But he was so young, younger surely than she. He had been only 36 when he died. Maybe this was their way of calming her fears. If so, they were very thoughtful. She guided him back toward her few possessions, her arm around his waist. He certainly felt substantial enough. If there were gear trains and integrated circuits underneath his skin, they were well hidden. So how are we doing? She asked. The question was ambiguous. I mean, I know. It took you many years from receipt of the message to your arrival here. Do you grade on speed or accuracy? Neither. You mean we haven't completed the test yet? He did not answer. Well, explain it to me. She said this in some distress. Some of us have spent years decrypting the message and building the machine. Aren't you going to tell me what it's all about?
You've become a real scrapper, he said, as if he really were her father, as if he were comparing his last recollections of her with her present, still incompletely developed self. He gave her hair an affectionate tousle. She remembered that from childhood also. But how could they, 30,000 light years from Earth, know her father's affectionate gestures in long ago and far away Wisconsin? Suddenly she knew.
Dreams, she said. Last night, when we were all dreaming, you were inside our heads, right? You drained everything we know.
We only made copies. I think everything that used to be in your head is still there. Take a look. Tell me if anything's missing.
He grinned and went on.
There was so much your television programs didn't tell us. Oh, we could figure out your technological level pretty well and a lot more about you. But there's so much more to your species than that. Things we couldn't possibly learn indirectly. I recognize you may feel some breach of privacy. You're joking. But we have so little time.
You mean the test is over?
We answered all your questions while we were asleep last night? So, did we pass or fail? It isn't like that, he said. It isn't like sixth grade. She had been in the sixth grade the year he died. Don't think of us as some interstellar sheriff gunning down outlaw civilizations. Think of us more as the Office of the Galactic Census. We collect information. I know you think nobody has anything to learn from you because you're technologically so backward. But there are other merits to a civilization.
What merits?
Oh, music? Loving kindness? I like that word.
Dreams?
Humans are very good at dreaming, although you'd never know it from your television. There are cultures all over the galaxy that trade dreams. You operate on interstellar cultural exchange?
That's what this is all about?
You don't care if some rapacious, bloodthirsty civilization develops interstellar spaceflight? I said we admire loving kindness.
If the Nazis had taken over the world,
our world, and then developed interstellar spaceflight, wouldn't you have stepped in? You'd be surprised how rarely something like that happens. In the long run, the aggressive civilizations destroy themselves, almost always. It's their nature. They can't help it. In such a case, our job would be to leave them alone, to make sure that no one bothers them, to let them work out their destiny.
Then why didn't you leave us alone?
I'm not complaining, mind you. I'm only curious as to how the Office of the Galactic Census works. The first thing you picked up from us was that Hitler broadcast. Why did you make contact? The picture, of course, was alarming. We could tell you were in deep trouble. But the music told us something else. The Beethoven told us there was hope. Marginal cases are our specialty. We thought you could use a little help. Really, we can offer only a little. You understand, there are certain limitations imposed by causality. He had crouched down, running his hands through the water, and was now drying them on his pants. Last night we looked inside you, all five of you. There's a lot in there. Feelings, memories, instincts, learned behavior, insights, madness, dreams, loves. Love is very important. You're an interesting mix.
All that in one night's work?
She was taunting him a little. We had to hurry. We have a pretty tight schedule.
Why is something about to...
No, it's just that if we don't engineer a consistent causality, it'll work itself out on its own. Then it's almost always worse. She had no idea what he meant. Engineer a consistent causality. My dad never used to talk like that.
Certainly he did.
Don't you remember how he spoke to you? He was a well-read man. And from when you were a little girl, I talked to you as an equal. Don't you remember?
She remembered.
She thought of her mother in the nursing home.
What a nice pendant, he said, with just that air of fatherly reserve she had always imagined he would have cultivated had he lived to see her adolescence.
Who gave it to you?
Oh, this, she said, fingering the medallion. Actually, it's from somebody I don't know very well. He tested my faith. But you must know all this already.
Again, the grin.
I want to know what you think of us, she said shortly. What you really think.
He did not hesitate for a moment.
All right.
I think it's amazing that you've done as well as you have. You've got hardly any theory of social organization. Astonishingly backward economic systems, no grasp of the machinery of historical prediction, and very little knowledge about yourselves.
Considering how fast your world is changing, it's amazing you haven't blown yourself to bits by now.
That's why we don't want to write you off just yet. You humans have a certain talent for adaptability, at least in the short term.
That's the issue, isn't it?
That's one issue. You can see that after a while, the civilizations with only short-term perspectives just aren't around. They work out their destinies also.
She wanted to ask him how he honestly felt about humans. Curiosity? Compassion? No feelings whatever, just all in a day's work? In his heart of hearts, or whatever equivalent internal organs he possessed, did he think of her as she thought of an ant? But she could not bring herself to raise the question. She was too much afraid of the answer. From the intonation of his voice, from the nuances of his speech, she tried to gain some glimpse of who it was here disguised as her father. She had an enormous amount of direct experience with human beings. The station masters had less than a day's. Could she not discern something of their true nature beneath this amiable and informative facade? But she couldn't. In the content of his speech, he was, of course, not her father, nor did he pretend to be. But in every other respect, he was uncannily close to Theodore F. Arroway, 1924 to 1960, vendor of hardware, loving husband and father. If not for a continuous effort of will, she knew she would be slobbering over this copy. Part of her kept wanting to ask him how things had been since he had gone to heaven. What were his views on Advent and Rapture? Was anything special in the works for the millennium? There were human cultures that taught an afterlife of the blessed on mountaintops or in clouds, in caverns or oases. But she could not recall any in which, if you were very, very good when you died, you went to the beach. Do we have time for some questions before whatever it is we have to do next? Sure. One or two, anyway. Tell me about your transportation system. I can do better than that, he said. I can show you. Steady now. An amoeba of blackness leaked out from the zenith, obscuring sun and blue sky.
Oh, that's quite a trick, she gasped.
The same sandy beach was beneath her feet. She dug her toes in. Overhead was the cosmos. They were, it seemed, high above the Milky Way galaxy, looking down on its spiral structure and falling toward it at some impossible speed. He explained matter-of-factly, using her own familiar scientific language to describe the vast pinwheel-shaped structure. He showed her the Orion spiral arm, in which the sun was, in this epoch, embedded. Interior to it, in decreasing order of mythological significance, were the Sagittarius arm, the Norma Scutum arm, and the 3 kiloparsec arm. A network of straight lines appeared, representing the transportation system they had used. It was like the illuminated maps in the Paris metro. Ada had been right. Each station, she deduced, was in a star system with a low-mass double black hole. She knew the black holes couldn't have resulted from stellar collapse, from the normal evolution of massive star systems, because they were too small. Maybe they were primordial, left over from the Big Bang, captured by some unimaginable starship and towed to their designated station. Or maybe they were made from scratch. She wanted to ask about this, but the tour was pressing breathlessly onward. There was a disk of glowing hydrogen rotating about the center of the galaxy, and within it a ring of molecular clouds rushing outward toward the periphery of the Milky Way. He showed her the ordered motions in the giant molecular cloud complex Sagittarius B2, which had for decades been a favorite hunting ground for complex organic molecules by her radio astronomical colleagues on Earth. Closer to the center, they encountered another giant molecular cloud, and then Sagittarius A West, an intense radio source that Ellie herself had observed at Argus. And just adjacent, at the very center of the galaxy, locked in a passionate gravitational embrace, was a pair of immense black holes. The mass of one of them was 5 million suns. Rivers of gas the size of solar systems were pouring down its maw. Too colossal, she ruminated on the limitations of the languages of Earth. Two supermassive black holes are orbiting one another at the center of the galaxy. One had been known, or at least strongly suspected. But two? Shouldn't that have shown up as a Doppler displacement of spectral lines? She imagined a sign under one of them reading entrance and under the other exit. At the moment, the entrance was in use. The exit was merely there. And that was where this station, Grand Central Station, was, just safely outside the black holes at the center of the galaxy. The skies were made brilliant by millions of nearby young stars, but the stars, the gas, and the dust were being eaten up by the entrance black hole.
It goes somewhere, right?
She asked.
Of course.
Can you tell me where?
Sure.
All this stuff winds up in Cygnus A. Cygnus A was something she knew about. Except only for a nearby supernova remnant in Cassiopeia, it was the brightest radio source in the skies of Earth. She had calculated that in 1 second, Cygnus A produces more energy than the sun does in 40,000 years. The radio source was 600 million light years away, far beyond the Milky Way, out in the realm of the galaxies. As with many extragalactic radio sources, two enormous jets of gas, fleeing apart at almost the speed of light, were making a complex web of Rankine-Hugoniot shock fronts with the thin intergalactic gas, and producing in the process a radio beacon that shone brightly over most of the universe. All the matter in this enormous structure, 500,000 light years across, was pouring out of a tiny, almost inconspicuous point in space, exactly midway between the jets.
You're making Cygnus A?
She half remembered a summer's night in Michigan when she was a girl. She had feared she would fall into the sky.
Oh, it's not just us. This is a cooperative project of many galaxies. That's what we mainly do, engineering. Only a few of us are involved with emerging civilizations.
At each pause, she had felt a kind of tingling in her head, approximately in the left parietal lobe. There are cooperative projects between galaxies? She asked.
Lots of galaxies? Each with a kind of central administration? With hundreds of billions of stars in each galaxy?
And then those administrations cooperate?
To pour millions of suns into Centaurus... Sorry, Cygnus A. Forgive me. I'm just staggered by the scale.
Why would you do all this? Whatever for?
You mustn't think of the universe as a wilderness. It hasn't been that for billions of years, he said. Think of it more as cultivated.
Again, a tingling.
But what for? What's there to cultivate?
Oh, the basic problem is easily stated. Now, don't get scared off by the scale. You're an astronomer, after all. The problem is that the universe is expanding. And there's not enough matter in it to stop the expansion. After a while, no new galaxies, no new stars, no new planets, no newly arisen life forms, just the same old crowd. Everything's getting run down. It'll be boring. So in Cygnus A, we're testing out the technology to make something new. You might call it an experiment in urban renewal. It's not our only trial run. Sometime later, we might want to close off a piece of the universe and prevent space from getting more and more empty as the eons pass. Increasing the local matter density is the way to do it, of course. It's good, honest work. Like running a hardware store in Wisconsin. If Cygnus A was 600 million light years away, then astronomers on Earth, or anywhere in the Milky Way for that matter, were seeing it as it had been 600 million years ago. But on Earth, 600 million years ago, she knew, there had hardly been any life, even in the oceans big enough to shake a stick at. They were old. 600 million years ago, on a beach like this one, except no crabs, no gulls, no palm trees. She tried to imagine some microscopic plant washed ashore, securing a tremulous toehold just above the waterline. While these beings were occupied with experimental galactogenesis and introductory cosmic engineering. You've been pouring matter into Cygnus A for the last 600 million years? Well, what you've detected by radio astronomy was just some of our early feasibility testing. We're much further along now.
And in due course, in another few hundred million years, she imagined, radio astronomers on Earth, if any, will detect substantial progress in the reconstruction of the universe around Cygnus A. She steeled herself for further revelations and vowed she would not let them intimidate her. There was a hierarchy of beings on a scale she had not imagined.
But the Earth had a place, a significance in that hierarchy. They would not have gone to all this trouble for nothing. The blackness rushed back to the zenith and was consumed. Sun and blue sky returned. The scene was the same. Surf, sand, palms, Magritte door, microcamera, frond, and her father. Those moving interstellar clouds and rings near the center of the galaxy, aren't they due to periodic explosions around here? Isn't it dangerous to locate the station here? Episodic, not periodic. It only happens on a small scale. Nothing like the sort of thing we're doing in Cygnus A. And it's manageable. We know when it's coming, and we generally just hunker down. If it's really dangerous, we take the station somewhere else for a while. This is all routine, you understand? Of course. Routine. You built it all? The subways, I mean? You and those other engineers from other galaxies? Oh, no, we haven't built any of it. I've missed something. Help me understand. It seems to be the same everywhere. In our case, we emerged a long time ago on many different worlds in the Milky Way. The first of us developed interstellar spaceflight and eventually chanced on one of the transit stations. Of course, we didn't know what it was. We weren't even sure it was artificial until the first of us were brave enough to slide down. Who's we? You mean the ancestors of your race, your species? No. We're many species from many worlds. Eventually, we found a large number of subways. Various ages, various styles of ornamentation, and all abandoned. Most were still in good working condition. All we did was make some repairs and improvements. No other artifacts? No dead cities? No records of what happened? No subway builders left? He shook his head. No industrialized, abandoned planets? He repeated the gesture. There was a galaxy-wide civilization that picked up and left without leaving a trace, except for the stations? That's more or less right. And it's the same in other galaxies also. Billions of years ago, they all went somewhere. We haven't the slightest idea where. But where could they go? He shook his head for the third time, but now very slowly. So then you're not... No. We're just caretakers, he said. Maybe someday they'll come back. Okay, just one more, she pleaded, holding her index finger up before her, as probably had been her practice at age 2. One more question. All right, he answered tolerantly, but we only have a few minutes left. She glanced at the doorway again and suppressed a tremor as a small, almost transparent crab sidled by. I want to know about your myths, your religions. What fills you with awe? Or are those who make the numinous unable to feel it? Oh, you make the numinous also. No, I know what you're asking. Certainly we feel it. You recognize that some of this is hard for me to communicate to you. But I'll give you an example of what you're asking for. I don't say this is it exactly, but it'll give you a... He paused momentarily, and again she felt a tingle, this time in her left occipital lobe. She entertained the notion that he was rifling through her neurons. Had he missed something last night? If so, she was glad. It meant they weren't perfect. Flavor of our numinous. It concerns pi, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. You know it well, of course, and you also know you can never come to the end of pi. There's no creature in the universe, no matter how smart, who could calculate pi to the last digit, because there is no last digit, only an infinite number of digits. Your mathematicians have made an effort to calculate it out to, Again, she felt the tingle. None of you seem to know. Let's say the 10 billionth place. You won't be surprised to hear that other mathematicians have gone further. Well, eventually. Let's say it's in the 10 to the 20th power place. Something happens. The randomly varying digits disappear. And for an unbelievably long time, there's nothing but ones and zeros. Idly, he was tracing a circle out on the sand with his toe. She paused a heartbeat before replying. And the zeros and ones finally stop? You get back to a random sequence of digits? Seeing a faint sign of encouragement from him, she raced on. And the number of zeros and ones? Is it a product of prime numbers?
Yes,
11 of them.
You're telling me there's a message in 11 dimensions hidden deep inside the number pi? Someone in the universe communicates by mathematics?
But help me, I'm really having trouble understanding you. Mathematics isn't arbitrary. I mean, pi has to have the same value everywhere. How can you hide a message inside pi? It's built into the fabric of the universe.
Exactly. She stared at him. It's even better than that, he continued. Let's assume that only in base 10 arithmetic does the sequence of zeros and ones show up, although you'd recognize that something funny's going on in any other arithmetic. Let's also assume that the beings who first made this discovery had 10 fingers. You see how it looks? It's as if pi has been waiting for billions of years for 10-fingered mathematicians with fast computers to come along. You see, the message was kind of addressed to us.
But this is just a metaphor, right? It's not really pi and the 10 to the 20th place. You don't actually have 10 fingers.
Not really. He smiled at her again.
Well, for heaven's sake, what does the message say?
He paused for a moment, raised an index finger, and then pointed to the door. A small crowd of people was excitedly pouring out of it. They were in a jovial mood, as if this were a long-delayed picnic outing. Ada was accompanying a stunning young woman in a brightly colored blouse and skirt, her hair neatly covered with a lacy gele favored by Muslim women in Yorubaland. He was clearly overjoyed to see her. From photographs he had shown, Ellie recognized her as Ada's wife. Sukhavati was holding hands with an earnest young man, his eyes large and soulful. She assumed it was Surinder Ghosh, Devi's long-dead medical student husband. She was in animated discourse with a small, vigorous man of commanding demeanor. He had drooping, wispy mustaches and was garbed in a richly brocaded and beaded gown. Ellie imagined him personally overseeing the construction of the funerary model of the Middle Kingdom, shouting instructions to those who poured the mercury. Vege ushered over a girl of 11 or 12, her blonde braids bobbing as she walked.
This is my granddaughter, Nina.
More or less.
My grand duchess. I should have introduced you before, in Moscow.
Ellie embraced the girl. She was relieved that Vege had not appeared with Mira, the ecclesiast. Ellie observed his tenderness toward Nina and decided she liked him more than ever. Over all the years she had known him, he had kept this secret place within his heart well hidden.
I have not been a good father to her mother, he confided. These days I hardly see Nina at all.
She looked around her. The station masters had produced for each of the five what could only be described as their deepest loves. Perhaps it was only to ease the barriers of communication with another appallingly different species. She was glad none of them were happily chatting with an exact copy of themselves. What if you could do this back on Earth? She wondered. What if, despite all our pretense and disguise, it was necessary to appear in public with the person we loved most of all? Imagine this, a prerequisite for social discourse on Earth. It would change everything. She imagined a phalanx of members of one sex surrounding a solitary member of the other, or chains of people, circles, the letters H or Q, lazy figure eights. You could monitor deep affections at a glance just by looking at the geometry, a kind of general relativity applied to social psychology. The practical difficulties of such an arrangement would be considerable, but no one would be able to lie about love. The caretakers were in a polite but determined hurry. There was not much time to talk. The entrance to the airlock of the dodecahedron was now visible, roughly where it had been when they first arrived. By symmetry, or perhaps because of some interdimensional conservation law, the Magritte doorway had vanished. They introduced everyone. She felt silly in more ways than one, explaining in English to the Emperor Quinn who her father was. But she dutifully translated, and they all solemnly shook hands as if this were their first encounter, perhaps at a suburban barbecue.
Ada's wife was a considerable beauty, and Surinder Ghosh was giving her a more than casual inspection. Devi did not seem to mind. Perhaps she was merely gratified at the accuracy of the imposture.
"Where did you go when you stepped through the doorway?" Ellie softly asked her.
416 Maiden Hallway, she answered.
Ellie looked at her blankly.
"London, 1973, with Surinder."
She nodded her head in his direction.
"Before he died."
Ellie wondered what she would have found had she crossed that threshold on the beach. Wisconsin in the late 50s, probably. She hadn't shown up on schedule, so he had come to find her. He had done that in Wisconsin more than once. Ada had also been told about a message deep inside a transcendental number. But in his story, it was not pi or e, the base of natural logarithms, but a class of numbers she had never heard of. With an infinity of transcendental numbers, they would never know for sure which number to examine back on Earth.
"I hungered to stay and work on it," he told Ellie softly, "and I sensed they needed help, some way of thinking about the decipherment that hadn't occurred to them. But I think it's something very personal for them. They don't want to share it with others. And realistically, I suppose we just aren't smart enough to give them a hand."
They hadn't decrypted the message in Pi? The station masters, the caretakers, the designers of new galaxies hadn't figured out a message that had been sitting under their thumbs for a galactic rotation or two? Was the message that difficult, or were they...
"Time to go home," her father said gently. It was wrenching. She didn't want to go.
She tried staring at the palm frond. She tried asking more questions. "How do you mean, go home? You mean we're going to emerge somewhere in the solar system? How will we get down to Earth?"
"You'll see," he answered.
"It'll be interesting." He put his arm around her waist, guiding her toward the open airlock door. It was like bedtime. You could be cute, you could ask bright questions, and maybe they'd let you stay up a little later. It used to work. At least a little.
"The Earth is linked up now, right? Both ways. If we can go home, you can come down to us in a jiffy.
You know, that makes me awfully nervous. Why don't you just sever the link?
We'll take it from here."
"Sorry, Presh," he replied, as if she had already shamelessly prolonged her 8 o'clock bedtime. Was he sorry about bedtime? Or about being unready to denozzle the tunnel? "For a while, at least. It'll be open only to inbound traffic," he said. "But we don't expect to use it." She liked the isolation of the Earth from Vega. She preferred a 52-year-long leeway between unacceptable behavior on Earth and the arrival of a punitive expedition. The black hole link was uncomfortable. They could arrive almost instantaneously, perhaps only in Hokkaido, perhaps anywhere on Earth. It was a transition to what Haddon had called micro-intervention. No matter what assurances they gave, they would watch us more closely now. No more dropping in for a casual look-see every few million years. She explored her discomfort further. How theological the circumstances had become. Here were beings who live in the sky, beings enormously knowledgeable and powerful, beings concerned for our survival, beings with a set of expectations about how we should behave. They disclaimed such a role, but they could clearly visit reward and punishment, life and death on the puny inhabitants of Earth. Now, how is this different, she asked herself, from the old-time religion? The answer occurred to her instantly. It was a matter of evidence. In her videotapes, in the data the others had acquired, there would be hard evidence of the existence of the station, of what went on here, of the black hole transit system. There would be 5 independent, mutually corroborative stories supported by compelling physical evidence. This one was fact, not hearsay and hocus-pocus. She turned toward him and dropped the frond. Wordlessly, he stooped and returned it to her. "You've been very generous in answering all my questions. Can I answer any for you?"
"Thanks.
You answered all our questions last night."
"That's it?
No commandments? No instructions for the provincials?"
"It doesn't work that way, Presh.
You're grown up now. You're on your own." He tilted his head, gave her that grin, and she flew into his arms, her eyes again filling with tears. It was a long embrace. Eventually, she felt him gently disengage her arms. It was time to go to bed. She imagined holding up her index finger and asking for still one more minute, but she did not want to disappoint him. "Bye, Presh," he said. "Give your mother my love."
"Take care,"
she replied in a small voice. She took one last look at the seashore at the center of the galaxy. A pair of seabirds, petrels perhaps, were suspended on some rising column of air. They remained aloft with hardly a beat of their wings. Just at the entrance to the airlock, she turned and called to him. "What does your message say? The one in Pi?" "We don't know," he replied a little sadly, taking a few steps toward her. "Maybe it's a kind of statistical accident. We're still working on it." The breeze stirred up, tousling her hair once again. "Well, give us a call when you figure it out," she said. Chapter 21. Causality. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. William Shakespeare, King Lear, 4/1/36. Who is all-powerful should fear everything. Pierre Corneille, Cinna, 1640, Act 4, Scene 2. They were overjoyed to be back. They whooped it up, giddy with excitement. They climbed over the chairs, they hugged and patted one another on the back. All of them were close to tears. They had succeeded. But not only that, they had returned, safely negotiating all the tunnels. Abruptly, amidst a hail of static, the radio began blaring out the machine status report. All three Benzels were decelerating. The built-up electrical charge was dissipating. From the commentary, it was clear that Project had no idea of what had happened. Ellie wondered how much time had passed. She glanced at her watch. It had been a day, at least, which would bring them well into the year 2000. Appropriate enough. "Oh, wait till they hear what we have to tell them," she thought. Reassuringly, she padded the compartment where the dozens of video microcassettes were stored. How the world would change when these films were released. The space between and around the Benzels had been repressurized. The airlock doors were being opened. Now there were radio inquiries about their well-being. "We're fine," she shouted back into her microphone. "Let us out. You won't believe what happened to us." The five emerged from the airlock, happy, effusively greeting their comrades who had helped build and operate the machine. The Japanese technicians saluted them. Project officials surged toward them. Davy said quietly to Ellie, "As far as I can tell, everyone's wearing exactly the same clothing they did yesterday. Look at that ghastly yellow tie on Peter Valerian." "Oh, he wears that old thing all the time," Ellie replied. "His wife gave it to him." The clocks read 15:20. Activation had occurred close to 3 o'clock the previous afternoon, so they had been gone just a little over 24. "What day is it?" she asked. They looked at her uncomprehendingly. Something was wrong. "Peter, for heaven's sake, what day is it?"
"How do you mean?" Valerian answered. "It's today, Friday, December 31st, 1999. It's New Year's Eve. Is that what you mean? Ellie, are you all right?"
Vege was telling Arkhangelsky to let him begin at the beginning, but only after his cigarettes were produced. Project officials and representatives of the machine consortium were converging around them. She saw Jurhir wedging his way to her through the crowd. "From your perspective, what happened?" she asked as finally he came within conversational range.
"Nothing. The vacuum system worked, the Benzels spun up, they accumulated quite an electrical charge, they reached the prescribed speed, and then everything reversed."
"What do you mean, everything reversed?"
"The Benzels slowed down and the charge dissipated. The system was repressurized, the Benzels stopped, and all of you came out. The whole thing took maybe 20 minutes, and we couldn't talk to you while the Benzels were spinning. Did you experience anything at all?"
She laughed.
"Oh, Ken, my boy," she said, "have I got a story for you."
There was a party for project personnel to celebrate machine activation and the momentous new year. Ellie and her traveling companions did not attend. The television stations were full of celebrations, parades, exhibits, retrospectives, prognostications, and optimistic addresses by national leaders. She caught a glimpse of remarks by the Abbot Utsumi, beatific as ever. But she could not dawdle. Project Directorate had quickly concluded from the fragments of their adventures that the five had time to recount that something had gone wrong. They found themselves hustled away from the milling crowds of government and consortium officials for a preliminary interrogation. It was thought prudent, project officials explained, for each of the five to be questioned separately. Derheer and Valerian conducted her debriefing in a small conference room. There were other project officials present, including Vega's former student, Anatoly Goldman. She understood that Bobby Bui, who spoke Russian, was sitting in for the Americans during Vega's interrogation. They listened politely, and Peter was encouraging now and again. But they had difficulty understanding the sequence of events. Much of what she related somehow worried them. Her excitement was non-contagious. It was hard for them to grasp that the dodecahedron had been gone for 20 minutes, much less a day, because the armada of instruments exterior to the Benzels had filmed and recorded the event and reported nothing extraordinary. All that had happened, Valerian explained, was that the Benzels had reached their prescribed speed, several instruments of unknown purpose had the equivalent of their needles move, the Benzels slowed down and stopped, and the five emerged in a state of great excitement. He didn't exactly say babbling nonsense, but she could sense his concern. They treated her with deference, but she knew what they were thinking. The only function of the machine was in 20 minutes to produce a memorable illusion, or just possibly to drive the five of them mad. She played back the video microcassettes for them, each carefully labeled, Vega Ring System, for example, or Vega Radio Facility. Quintuple System, Galactic Center Starscape, and one bearing the inscription Beach. She inserted them in play mode one after the other. They had nothing on them. The cassettes were blank. She couldn't understand what had gone wrong. She had carefully learned the operation of the video microcamera system and had used it successfully in tests before machine activation. She had even done a spot check on some of the footage after they had left the Vega system. She was further devastated later when she was told that the instruments carried by the others had also somehow failed. Peter Valerian wanted to believe her, to hear also, but it was hard for them, even with the best will in the world. The story the five had come back with was a little, well, unexpected, and entirely unsupported by physical evidence. Also, there hadn't been enough time. They had been out of sight for only 20 minutes. This was not the reception she had expected. But she was confident it would all sort itself out. For the moment, she was content to play the experience back in her mind and make some detailed notes. She wanted to be sure she would forget nothing. Although a front of extremely cold air was moving in from Kamchatka, it was still unseasonably warm, when late on New Year's Day, a number of unscheduled flights arrived at Sapporo International Airport. The new American Secretary of Defense, Michael Kitts, and a team of hastily gathered experts arrived in an airplane marked the United States of America. Their presence was confirmed by Washington only when the story was about to break in Hokkaido. The terse press release noted that the visit was routine, that there was no crisis, no danger, and that nothing extraordinary has been reported at the Machine Systems Integration Facility northeast of Sapporo. A Tu-120 had flown overnight from Moscow, carrying, among others, Stefan Beruda and Timofey Gotsriche. Doubtless, neither group was delighted to spend this New Year's holiday away from their families, but the weather in Hokkaido was a pleasant surprise. It was so warm that the sculptures in Sapporo were melting, and the dodecahedron of ice had become an almost featureless small glacier, the water dripping off rounded surfaces that once had been the edges of the pentagonal surfaces. 2 days later, a severe winter storm struck. and all traffic into the machine facility, even by four-wheel drive vehicles, was interrupted. Some radio and all television links were severed. Apparently, a microwave relay tower had been blown down. During most of the new interrogations, the only communication with the outside world was by telephone. And, just conceivably, Ellie thought, by dodecahedron. She was tempted to steal herself on board and spin up the Benzels. She enjoyed elaborating on this fantasy, but in fact there was no way to know whether the machine would ever work again, at least from this side of the tunnel. He had said it would not. She allowed herself to think of the seashore again. And him. Whatever happened next, a wound deep within her was being healed. She could feel the scar tissue knitting. It had been the most expensive psychotherapy in the history of the world. And that's saying a lot, she thought. Debriefings were given to Xi and Sukhavati by representatives of their nations. Although Nigeria played no significant role in message acquisition or machine construction, Ada acquiesced readily enough to a long interview with Nigerian officials. But it was perfunctory compared with the interrogations administered to them by project personnel. Vege and Ellie underwent still more elaborate debriefings by the high-level teams brought from the Soviet Union and the United States for this specific purpose. At first, these American and Soviet interrogations excluded foreign nationals. But after complaints were carried through the World Machine Consortium, the U.S. and the SU relented, and the sessions were again internationalized. Kitz was in charge of her debriefing, and considering what short notice he must have been given, he had arrived surprisingly well prepared. Valerian and Zerhir put in an occasional good word for her, and every now and then asked a searching question. But it was Kitz's show. He told her he was approaching her story skeptically but constructively, in what he hoped was the best scientific tradition. He trusted she would not mistake the directness of his questions for some personal animus. He held her only in the greatest respect. He, in turn, would not permit his judgment to be clouded by the fact that he had been against the machine project from the beginning. She decided to let this pathetic deception pass unchallenged, and began her story. At first, he listened closely, asked occasional questions of detail, and apologized when he interrupted. By the second day, no such courtesies were in evidence. So the Nigerian is visited by his wife, the Indian by her dead husband, the Russian by his cute granddaughter, the Chinese by some Mongol warlord. Quinn was not a Mongol. And you, for Christ's sake, you get visited by your dearly departed father, who tells you that he and his friends have been busy rebuilding the universe, for Christ's sake. Our Father who art in heaven. This is straight religion. This is straight cultural anthropology. This is straight Sigmund Freud, don't you see that? Not only do you claim your own father came back from the dead, you actually expect us to believe that he made the universe. You're distorting what... I'll come off it, Arroway. Don't insult our intelligence. You don't present us with a shred of evidence, and you expect us to believe the biggest cock and bull story of all time? You know better than that. You're a smart lady. How could you figure to get away with it? She protested. Valerian protested also. This kind of interrogation, he said, was a waste of time. The machine was undergoing sensitive physical tests at this moment. That was how the validity of her story could be checked. Kitz agreed the physical evidence would be important, but the nature of Arroway's story, he argued, was revealing a means of understanding what had actually happened. Meeting your father in heaven and all that, Dr. Arroway, is telling, because you've been raised in the Judeo-Christian culture. You're essentially the only one of the five from that culture, and you're the only one who meets your father. Your story is just too pat. It's not imaginative enough. This was worse than she had thought possible. She felt a moment of epistemological panic, as when your car is not where you parked it or the door you locked last night is ajar in the morning. You think we made all this up? Well, I'll tell you, Dr. Arroway. When I was very young, I worked in the Cook County Prosecutor's Office. When they were thinking about indicting somebody, they asked three questions. He ticked them off on his fingers.
Did he have the opportunity? Did he have the means? Did he have the motive?
To do what? He looked at her in disgust. But our watches showed that we'd been gone more than a day, she protested.
Ah, I don't know how I could have been so stupid, Kit said, striking his forehead with his palm. You've demolished my argument. I forgot that it's impossible to set your watch ahead by a day.
But that implies a conspiracy.
You think she lied? You think Ada lied?
What I think is we should move on to something more important. You know, Peter, Kitz turned toward Valerian, I'm persuaded you're right. A first draft of the materials assessment report will be here tomorrow morning. Let's not waste more time on stories. We'll adjourn till then.
Durhir had said not a word through the entire afternoon session. He offered her an uncertain grin, and she couldn't help contrasting it with her father's. Sometimes Ken's expression seemed to urge her, to implore her. But to what end, she had no way of knowing. Perhaps to change her story. He had remembered her recollections of her childhood, and he knew how she had grieved for her father. Clearly, he was weighing the possibility that she had gone crazy. By extension, she supposed, he was also considering the likelihood that the others had gone crazy, too. Mass hysteria, shared delusion, folie à cinq.
Well, here it is, Kit said. The report was about a centimeter thick. He let it fall to the table, scattering a few pencils. You'll want to look through it, Dr. Arroway, but I can give you a quick summary, okay?
She nodded assent. She had heard through the grapevine that the report was highly favorable to the account the five had given. She hoped it would put an end to the nonsense.
The dodecahedron, apparently, he laid great stress on this word, has been exposed to a very different environment than the benzyls and the supporting structures. It's apparently been subjected to huge tensile and compressional stresses. It's a miracle the thing didn't fall to pieces. So it's a miracle you and the others didn't fall to pieces at the same time. Also, it's apparently seen an intense radiation environment. There's low-level induced radioactivity, cosmic ray tracks, and so on. It's another miracle that you survived the radiation. Nothing else has been added or taken away. There's no sign of erosion or scraping on the side vertices that you claim kept bumping into the walls of the tunnels. There's not even any scoring, as there would have been if it entered the Earth's atmosphere at high velocity.
So doesn't that confirm our story? Michael, think about it. Tensile and compressional stresses? Tidal forces are exactly what you expect if you fall down a classical black hole. That's been known for 50 years at least. I don't know why we didn't feel it, but maybe the dodec protected us somehow. And high radiation doses from the inside of the black hole and from the environment of the galactic center, a known gamma ray source. There's independent evidence for black holes, and there's independent evidence for a galactic center. We didn't make those things up. I don't understand the absence of scraping, but that depends on the interaction of a material we've hardly studied with a material that's completely unknown. I wouldn't expect any scoring or charring because we don't claim we entered through the Earth's atmosphere. It seems to me the evidence almost entirely confirms our story. What's the problem?
The problem is you people are too clever.
Too clever. Look at it from the point of view of a skeptic. Step back and look at the big picture. There's a bunch of bright people in different countries who think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. They claim to receive a complex message from space. Claim? Let me continue. They decrypt the message and announce instructions on how to build a very complicated machine at a cost of trillions of dollars. The world's in a funny condition. The religions are all shaky about the oncoming millennium, and to everybody's surprise, the machine gets built. There's one or two slight changes in personnel, and then essentially these same people... It's not the same people. It's not Sukhavati, it's not Ada, it's not Chi, and there were... Let me continue. Essentially, these same people then get to sit down in the machine. Because of the way the thing is designed, no one can see them and no one can talk to them after the thing is activated. So the machine is turned on and then it turns itself off. Once it's on, you can't make it stop in less than 20 minutes, okay?
20 minutes later, these same people emerge from the machine, all jaunty jolly with some bullshit story about traveling faster than light inside black holes to the center of the galaxy and back. Now suppose you hear this story and you're just ordinarily cautious. You ask to see their evidence. Pictures, videotapes, any other data. Guess what? It's all been conveniently erased. Do they have artifacts of the superior civilization they say is at the center of the galaxy? No. Mementos? No. A stone tablet? No. Pets? No, nothing. The only physical evidence is some subtle damage done to the machine. So you ask yourself, couldn't people who were so motivated and so clever arrange for what looks like tension stresses and radiation damage, especially if they could spend $2 trillion faking the evidence? She gasped. She remembered the last time she had gasped. This was a truly venomous reconstruction of events. She wondered what had made it attractive to Kitz. He must, she thought, be in real distress. I don't think anybody's going to believe your story, he continued. This is the most elaborate and the most expensive hoax ever perpetrated. You and your friends tried to hoodwink the President of the United States and deceive the American people, to say nothing of all the other governments on the earth. You must really think everybody else is stupid. Michael, this is madness. Tens of thousands of people worked to acquire the message, to decode it, and to build the machine. The message is on magnetic tapes and printouts and laser discs in observatories all over the world. You think there's a conspiracy involving all the radio astronomers on the planet? And the aerospace and cybernetics companies? And no. You don't need a conspiracy that big. All you need is a transmitter in space that looks as if it's broadcasting from Vega. I'll tell you how I think you did it. You prepare the message and get somebody with an established launch capability to put it up. Probably as an incidental part of some other mission. And into some orbit that looks like sidereal motion. Maybe there's more than one satellite. Then the transmitter turns on and you're all ready in your handy-dandy observatory to receive the message, make the big discovery, and tell us poor slobs what it all means. This was too much even for the impassive to hear. He roused himself from a slumped position in his chair. Really, Mike, he began. But Ellie cut him short. I wasn't responsible for most of the decoding. Lots of people were involved, Drumlin especially. He started out as a committed skeptic, as you know, but once the data came in, Dave was entirely convinced. You didn't hear any reservations from him. Oh, yes, poor Dave Drumlin. The late Dave Drumlin, you set him up. The professor you never liked. Durheer slumped still further down in his chair, and she had a sudden vision of him regaling Kitz with second-hand pillow talk. She looked at him more closely. She couldn't be sure. During the decrypting of the message, you couldn't do everything. There was so much you had to do. So you overlooked this, and you forgot that. Here's Drumlin, growing old, worried about his former student eclipsing him and getting all the credit. Suddenly he sees how to be involved, how to play a central role. You appealed to his narcissism and you hooked him. And if he hadn't figured out the decryption, you would have helped him along. If worst came to worst, you would have peeled all the layers off the onion yourself. You're saying that we were able to invent such a message. Really, it's an outrageous compliment to Vega and me. It's also impossible. It can't be done. You ask any competent engineer if that kind of machine, with brand new subsidiary industries, components wholly unfamiliar on Earth, you ask if that could have been invented by a few physicists and radio astronomers on their days off. When do you imagine we had time to invent such a message, even if we knew how? Look how many bits of information are in it. It would have taken years. You had years, while Argus was getting nowhere. The project was about to be closed. Drumlin, you remember, was pushing that. So just at the right moment, you find the message. Oh, then there's no more talk about closing down your pet project. I think you and that Russian did cook the whole thing up in your spare time. You had years. This is madness, she said softly. Valerian interrupted. He had known Dr. Arroway well during the period in question. She had done productive scientific work. She never had the time required for so elaborate a deception. Much as he admired her, he agreed that the message and the machine were far beyond her ability, or indeed anybody's ability. Anybody on Earth. But Kitz wasn't buying it. That's a personal judgment, Dr. Valerian. There are many persons, and there can be many judgments. You're fond of Dr. Arroway. I understand I'm fond of her, too. It's understandable you would defend her. I don't take it amiss. But there's a clincher. You don't know about it yet. I'm going to tell you. He leaned forward, watching Ellie intently. Clearly, he was interested to see how she would respond to what he was about to say. The message stopped the moment we activated the machine. The moment the Benzels reached cruising speed. To the second. All over the world. Every radio observatory with a line of sight to Vega saw the same thing. We've held back telling you about it so we wouldn't distract you from your debriefing. The message stopped in mid-bit. Now that was really foolish of you. I don't know anything about it, Michael. But so what if the message stopped? It's fulfilled its purpose. We built the machine and we went to where they wanted us to go. It puts you in a peculiar position, he went on. Suddenly she saw where he was headed. She hadn't expected this. He was arguing conspiracy, but she was contemplating madness. If Kitz wasn't mad, might she be? If our technology can manufacture substances that induce delusions, could a much more advanced technology induce highly detailed collective hallucinations? Just for a moment, it seemed possible. Let's imagine it's last week, he was saying. The radio waves arriving on Earth right now are supposed to have been sent from Vega 26 years ago. They take 26 years to cross space to us. But 26 years ago, Dr. Arroway, there wasn't any Argus facility, and you were sleeping with acid heads and moaning about Vietnam and Watergate. Oh, you people are so smart. But you forgot the speed of light. There's no way that activating the machine can turn the message off until 26 years pass. Unless in ordinary space you can send a message faster than light. And we both know that's impossible. I remember you complaining about how stupid Rankin and Joss were for not knowing you can't travel faster than light. I'm surprised you thought you could get away with this one. Michael, listen. It's how we were able to get from here to there and back in no time flat. 20 minutes anyway. It can be acausal around a singularity. I'm not an expert on this. You should be talking to Ada or Vega. Thank you for the suggestion, he said. We already have. She imagined Vega under some comparably stern interrogation by his old adversary Arkhangelsky, or by Baruda, the man who had proposed destroying the radio telescopes and burning the data. Probably they and Kit saw eye to eye on the awkward matter before them. She hoped Vega was bearing up all right. You understand, Dr. Arroway? I'm sure you do. But let me explain again. Perhaps you can show me where I missed something. 26 years ago, those radio waves were heading out for Earth. Now imagine them in space between Vega and here. Nobody can catch the radio waves after they've left Vega. Nobody can stop them. Even if the transmitter knew instantaneously, through the black hole, if you like, that the machine had been activated, it would be 26 years before the signal stops arriving on Earth. Your Vegans couldn't have known 26 years ago when the machine was going to be activated, and to the minute. You would have to send a message back in time to 26 years ago for the message to stop on December 31st, 1999. You do follow, don't you? Yes, I follow. This is wholly unexplored territory. You know, it's not called a space-time continuum for nothing. If they can make tunnels through space, I suppose they can make some kind of tunnels through time. The fact that we got back a day early shows that they have at least a limited kind of time travel. So maybe as soon as we left the station, they sent a message 26 years back into time to turn the transmission off. I don't know. Oh, you see how convenient it is for you that the message stops just now. If it was still broadcasting, we could find your little satellite, capture it, and bring back the transmission tape. That would be definitive evidence of a hoax. Unambiguous. But you couldn't risk that. So you're reduced to black hole mumbo-jumbo, probably embarrassing for you. He looked concerned. It was like some paranoid fantasy, in which a patchwork of innocent facts are reassembled into an intricate conspiracy. The facts in this case were hardly commonplace, and it made sense for the authorities to test other possible explanations. But Kitz's rendition of events was so maligned that it revealed she thought someone truly wounded, afraid, in pain. In her mind, the likelihood that all this was a collective delusion diminished a little. But the cessation of the message transmission, if it had happened as Kitz had said, was worrisome. "Now I tell myself, Dr. Arroway, you scientists had the brains to figure all this out, and the motivation, but by yourselves you didn't have the means. If it wasn't the Russians who put up this satellite for you, it could have been any one of half a dozen other national launch authorities. But we've looked into all that. Nobody launched a free-flying satellite in the appropriate orbits. That leaves private launch capability. And the most interesting possibility that's come to our notice is a Mr. S.R. Haddon. Know him? Oh, don't be ridiculous, Michael. I talked to you about Haddon before I went up to Methuselah. Just wanted to be sure we agree on the basics. Try this on for size. You and the Russian concoct this scheme. You get Haddon to bankroll the early stages, the satellite design, the invention of the machine, the encrypting of the message, faking the radiation damage, all that. In return, after the machine project gets going, he gets to play with some of that $2 trillion. Well, he likes the idea. There might be enormous profit in it. And from his history, he'd love to embarrass the government. When you get stuck in decrypting the message, when you can't find the primer, you even go to him. He tells you where to look for it. That was also careless. It would have been better if you figured it out yourself. Oh, it's too careless, offered Dahir. Wouldn't someone who was really perpetrating a hoax... Ken, I'm surprised at you. You've been very credulous, you know. You're demonstrating exactly why Arroway and the others thought it would be clever to ask Haddon's advice, and to make sure we knew she'd gone to see him. He returned his attention to her. Dr. Arroway, try to look at it from the standpoint of a neutral observer. Kitz pressed on, making sparkling new patterns of facts assemble themselves in the air before her, rewriting whole years of her life. She hadn't thought Kitz dumb, but she hadn't imagined him this inventive either. Perhaps he had received help, but the emotional propulsion for this fantasy came from Kitz. He was full of expansive gestures and rhetorical flourishes. This was not merely part of his job. This interrogation, this alternative interpretation of events, had roused something passionate in him. After a moment, she thought she saw what it was. The five had come back with no immediate military applications, no political liquid capital, but only a story that was surpassing strange. And that story had certain implications. Kitz was now master of the most devastating arsenal on Earth, while the caretakers were building galaxies. He was a lineal descendant of a progression of leaders, American and Soviet, who had devised the strategy of nuclear confrontation, while the caretakers were an amalgam of diverse species from separate worlds working together in concert. Their very existence was an unspoken rebuke. Then consider the possibility that the tunnel could be activated from the other end, that there might be nothing he could do to prevent it. They could be here in an instant. How could Kitz defend the United States under such circumstances? His role in the decision to build the machine, the history of which he seemed to be actively rewriting, could be interpreted by an unfriendly tribunal as dereliction of duty. And what account could Kitz give the extraterrestrials of his stewardship of the planet, he and his predecessors? Even if no avenging angels came storming out of the tunnel, if the truth of the journey got out, the world would change. It was already changing. It would change much more. Again, she regarded him with sympathy. For 100 generations, at least, the world had been run by people much worse than he. It was his misfortune to come to bat, just as the rules of the game were being rewritten. "Even if you believed every detail of your story," he was saying, "don't you think the extraterrestrials treated you badly? They take advantage of your tenderest feelings by dressing themselves up as dear old dad. They don't tell you what they're doing. They expose all your film, destroy all your data, and don't even let you leave that stupid palm frond up there. Nothing on the manifest is missing except for a little food, and nothing that isn't on the manifest is returned except for a little sand.
So in 20 minutes, you gobbled some food and dumped a little sand out of your pockets. You come back one nanosecond or something after you leave, so to any neutral observer, you never left at all. Now, if the extraterrestrials wanted to make it unambiguously clear you'd really gone somewhere, they would have brought you back a day later, or a week, right? If there was nothing inside the Benzels for a while, we'd be dead certain that you'd gone somewhere. If they wanted to make it easy for you, they wouldn't have turned off the message, right? That makes it look bad, you know. They could have figured that out. Why would they want to make it bad for you? And there's other ways they could have supported your story. They could have given you something to remember them by. They could have let you bring back your movies. Then nobody could claim all this is just a clever fake. So how come they didn't do that? How come the extraterrestrials don't confirm your story? You spent years of your life trying to find them. Don't they appreciate what you've done? Ellie, how can you be so sure your story really happened? If, as you claim, all this isn't a hoax, couldn't it be a delusion? It's painful to consider, I know. Nobody wants to think they've gone a little crazy. Considering the strain you've been under, though, it's no big deal. And if the only alternative is criminal conspiracy, maybe you want to carefully think this one through. She had already done so. Later that day, she met with Kitts alone. A bargain had, in effect, been proposed. She had no intention of going along with it. But Kitts was prepared for that possibility as well. "You never liked me from the first," he said. "But I'm going to rise above that. We're going to do something really fair. We've already issued a news release saying that the machine just didn't work when we tried to activate it. Naturally, we're trying to understand what went wrong. With all the other failures in Wyoming and Uzbekistan, nobody is doubting this one. Then in a few weeks, we'll announce that we're still not getting anywhere. We've done the best we could. The machine is too expensive to keep working on. Probably we're just not smart enough to figure it out yet. Also, there's still some danger, after all. We always knew that. The machine might blow up or something. So all in all, it's best to put the machine project on ice, at least for a while. It's not that we didn't try. Haddon and his friends would oppose it, of course, but as he's been taken from us... He's only 300 kilometers overhead, she pointed out. Oh, haven't you heard? Saul died just around the time the machine was activated. Funny how it happened. Sorry, I should have told you. I forgot you were, close to him. She did not know whether to believe Kitts. Haddon was in his 50s and had certainly seemed in good physical health. She would pursue this topic later. And what, in your fantasy, becomes of us? She asked. Us? Who's us? Us. The five of us, the ones who went aboard the machine that you claim never worked. Oh. After a little more debriefing, you'll be free to leave. I don't think any of you will be foolish enough to tell this cock-and-bull story on the outside. But just to be safe, we're preparing some psychiatric dossiers on the five of you. Profiles, low-key. You've always been a little rebellious, mad at the system, whichever system you grew up in. It's okay, it's good for people to be independent. We encourage that, especially in scientists. But the strain of the last few years has been trying. Not actually disabling, but trying. Especially for Doctors Arroway and Lunacharsky. First, they're involved in finding the message, decrypting it, and convincing the governments to build the machine. Then problems in construction. Industrial sabotage. Sitting through an activation that goes nowhere. It's been tough. All work and no play. And scientists are highly strung anyway. If you've all become a little unhinged at the failure of the machine, everybody will be sympathetic, understanding. But nobody will believe your story. Nobody. If you behave yourselves, there's no reason that the dossiers ever have to be released. It'll be clear that the machine is still here. We're having a few wire service photographers in to photograph it as soon as the roads are open. We'll show them the machine didn't go anywhere, and the crew... Well, the crew is naturally disappointed, maybe a little disheartened. They don't want to talk to the press just yet. Don't you think it's a neat plan? He smiled. He wanted her to acknowledge the beauty of the scheme. She said nothing. Don't you think we're being very reasonable after spending $2 trillion on that pile of shit? We could put you away for life, Arroway, but we're letting you go free. You don't even have to put up bail. I think we're behaving like gentlemen. It's the spirit of the millennium. It's Machindo.